Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
In 2020, events have again shone a light on inequalities across the globe, and Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to the elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. Hello and welcome to Policy Forum Pod, the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. I'm Martin Pierce. Policy Forum Pod is a product of policyforum.net, and we're based at Crawford School of Public Policy, the Asia Pacific's leading graduate policy school. Have you considered taking the next step in your career? And if so, one of our graduate programs might be the perfect stepping stone for you. Crawford School offers a wide range of courses and degrees available to give you the confidence and skills to take a leading role in public policy. You can check them out at crawford.anu.edu.au/study. Now, on Tuesday night, the Australian government delivered the long-awaited federal budget. Postponed in May due to the pandemic, this was the government's attempt to cushion the huge blow that's been dealt to the country by the coronavirus crisis. We already know that government has spent big. Last financial year, Australia's net debt was just $491 million, but that's now set to peak at nearly $1 trillion, or 44% of GDP in June 2024. That's a figure unthinkable just months ago, particularly from a government that was engaged in a seemingly single-minded pursuit of a budget surplus. There's a smorgasbord of stimulus and spending items in the budget: tax cuts, instant asset write-offs for businesses, the JobMaker hiring credit, additional cash payments for seniors, further spending for the National Disability Insurance Scheme, and much more. But the cost of the COVID-19 crisis extends beyond dollars and cents. While Australia's response to the crisis has been better than most, the country has still seen tragic loss of life and the devastating psychological toll of isolation and uncertainty. And while some of Australia's most vulnerable citizens were given temporary respite with the introduction of increased social assistance payments in the early days of the crisis, many are anxious about what lies ahead in what looks to be a very long road to recovery. Now, on yesterday's Democracy Sausage, you would have heard Mark Kenny and the team talk about a few of the issues that span out of the budget, particularly around tax and budget politics and the demographic challenge that Australia is facing. But on today's Policy Forum Pod, we are going to be asking, is the budget doing enough to support the Australians most in need as the country tries to rebuild from the pandemic? And to discuss one of the most important budgets in Australian history, we've invited a stellar panel of some of our favourite experts and regulars to come in and join us today. First of all, I'd like to welcome John Falzon, OAM. He is a senior fellow of inequality and social justice at Per Capita. He's a sociologist, a poet, and a social justice advocate, and was national CEO of the St. Vincent de Paul Society from 2006 to 2018. Hello, John.
G'day, Martin.
And welcome back to Dr. Anna Greta Hunter. She's a clinical senior lecturer at the ANU School of Medicine and a staff specialist at Canberra Hospital. Hello, Anna Greta.
Hi, Martin. Thanks for having me back.
It's great to have you back again. And of course, last but certainly not least, Professor Sharon Bassel. She is the Director of Gender Equity and Diversity at Crawford School. She heads the Children's Policy Centre, and she's the co-lead of the Individual Measure of Multidimensional Poverty Project, which we've been doing a podcast series of recently. Hello, Sharon. How are you?
Hi, Martin. I'm good. It's great to be here and very exciting to be in the office.
So welcome back to all three of you. Australia is facing a huge budget deficit in the 2020-21 financial year. That's the highest underlying cash deficit since the Second World War. Yet the government has decided that the way out of this is to commit to further tax cuts and the job maker subsidy, which will see Australian businesses receive up to $200 a week to hire young Australians that were previously on JobSeeker. Other budget items included $3.9 billion for the National Disability Insurance Scheme, a cash payment of $500 to seniors, and 23,000 in-home aged care packages. I just want to get a bit of a sense of the reaction in the room. Can I just go around and ask what you made of the budget? Were you surprised by the announcements in it? Perhaps, Anna Greta, if I start with you.
I thought the budget was underwhelming, and I have to say I wasn't particularly surprised by the contents. I thought we had in the weeks leading up to the budget on Tuesday, we'd been given a fair taste of what was coming, particularly in terms of social policy and things like health. There's been some small surprises, I think, as people dig through the finer detail. So issues like language testing for visa applications will start to come out. And so there may be some things that come or details that become more apparent, I think, as we digest the data. But I have to say it was underwhelming. The absence of vision was as expected from my perspective.
John, were you underwhelmed as well?
It's really what we saw coming, a budget of short-term cash and long-term uncertainty. It was well and truly a triumph of ideology over common sense and the common good. We were basically asked as a nation to place our trust in the discredited theory that given the right mix of tax breaks and deregulation, the jobs will come and the wealth will trickle down. Now, we've been told this promise by neoliberal ideologues for the past 40 years. And for the past 40 years, we've listened hard for the sound of the wealth trickling down, but all we've ever heard is the sound of the excluded still waiting. And this budget, it's truly a budget without a heart because it keeps the excluded still waiting. It's a budget that boosts inequality.
I do want to return to that topic of trickle-down economics soon, but first let me hear from you, Sharon. What was your take on it?
So I think the three of us are probably in wild agreement on many of these things. I guess for me, I was unsurprised. As John points out, I think we could see this coming. And interestingly, we could also see the big spending coming, but also the way in which that money was going to be spent. But while I was unsurprised, I was disappointed. I think we have had, as a result of this awful pandemic, a once-in-a-generation opportunity to really rethink the kind of society that we want to have and to think about how we can tackle some of the challenges that we've been facing. And for me, there are two absolutely fundamental challenges that Australia faces. And one is climate change, which of course is a global issue, and the other is inequality. And so how could we have addressed those things through this pause that we've had, this imposed pause of the pandemic, and then through a budget that is spending $1 trillion. That's a phenomenal amount of money to invest in a society, but it's not actually an investment. So I think it's incredibly disappointing because we don't see key things like investment in renewable energies, in renewable forms of energy that will lead to employment. We don't see issues that are fundamentally addressing inequality in this society. And so I think, as John says, it's very short term, and it's really missed that opportunity to reimagine what a just society might look like and to grasp that and make it happen.
I'm going to come back to you a little later on what that reimagining should have looked like and what a just society might have looked like out of this budget. But first of all, let's get into the weeds a little on some of the economic assumptions on the budget itself. The budget is based on some pretty optimistic predictions about economic growth and about the availability of an effective vaccine. Specifically, the government is anticipating GDP growth to bounce back to 4.75% in 2021-2022. John, do you think that's a realistic assessment?
I think we've got to be very careful about those forecasts. I don't think we can treat them as assumptions. What we've got to look squarely at is the current reality. And what's the current reality? Nearly 2.5 million of us are unemployed or underemployed. Nearly half of us who are in the workforce are in insecure work. Those of us on JobSeeker and JobKeeper have already had to taste that bitter medicine of austerity, and there's no sense of certainty for the future, if you are excluded from the labour market. So these are the realities that we need to deal with now. And as Sharon has mentioned, the climate emergency, that's an urgent reality now, pandemic or no pandemic. To rely on optimistic forecasts at the expense of those who are suffering now, the precarity that has not only been caused by the recession, but that has been deliberately engineered by policies that punish people who are excluded. This is unforgivable in a government.
Anna Grada, one of the assumptions that this budget makes is based on the fact that a vaccine will be fully in place by late 2021, with social distancing restrictions carrying on until that's available, and the expectation that outbreaks will occur, but they'll be largely contained. Is it premature to rely on having a vaccine fully rolled out by the end of next year?
I think we're still learning so much about this virus. We haven't even had 12 months of experience about the experience of this novel coronavirus. We don't understand what recovery looks like in terms of a 5-year recovery after infection. We're still coming to terms, I think, with the best way to control the infection on a population basis, and we're seeing that play out in a very real way in Victoria and particularly in Melbourne. And so I think the reputable assessments about vaccines is that we should be approaching that with caution, and the likelihood of having a guaranteed vaccine that is a durable vaccine and highly effective across a large proportion of the population is uncertain. The vaccine trials that are running are looking at efficacy rates of between 50 and 70% as a success for a vaccine. And then how does that actually play out when you're using that vaccine in a population? The science is complex. The infectious disease is complex, the medicine is complex. And so I think that to build that assumption into the model is potentially a little foolhardy. And it reminds me that this economic crisis that we're in is unique. And the principles of economics, which I'm certainly not expert in, but it gets you thinking a lot about supply and demand and about growth as economic ideas that we have as a goal. And the goal behind the budget appears to be stimulating growth. And stimulating growth depends on both supply and demand. And both of those things, both supply and demand, have been extraordinarily altered by this pandemic, okay, through either factories not being able to work or being shut down, through outbreaks of infection, or through populations of people not able to work because of control mechanisms to contain the infection. And so this is what I would have liked to see. This is the conversation that I think we should be having, is around these fundamental principles of growth, about supply and demand, and about what we should be doing with our time, how we'd like to look after our community, what sort of things we think are meaningful in our lives. And I share Sharon's thought that this is an extraordinary moment in time to be really questioning the role of government and how we can use this moment to make our best future.
Sharon, perhaps unsurprisingly, the government has focused a lot of its attention in this budget on job creation. We previously mentioned the JobMaker scheme, which is aiming to get people off job seeker payments into the workforce. And there's been some spending targeted at those who experience disadvantage, notably through the $3.9 billion in funding for the NDIS. But so far, there won't be any more money for the struggling residential aged care sector, which, of course, has been terribly hard hit in the pandemic. In your opinion, is the budget targeting those that actually need it most?
There are some extraordinary gaps in this budget. So you mentioned aged care, and the crisis that we've seen in aged care is not new in the context of this pandemic. We've known that there has been a crisis in aged care for years and years that we have failed to address. We've seen that crisis get worse as the federal government has had more responsibility around aged care. And we've seen what happens to that crisis in the context of pandemic. And what has happened is that people have died. That's pretty awful medicine to swallow, that some of our most vulnerable community members are dying because of the mismanagement of aged care over many years. So the fact that there hasn't been a focus, not just in budgetary terms, but in terms of the policies and the regulation around aged care and how we fix that, I think is extraordinary. And that does go beyond just the dollars that are involved. And of course, there is funding that is needed in aged care. But some of the principles underpinning the approach to aged care, I think, are extraordinary in a democratic society. The idea that we actually lock up older people and they cannot leave those facilities, that they are isolated from their communities and from their loved ones. These are values that I think we really need to fundamentally question, that go way beyond the funding mechanisms that are in place. But more broadly, if we think about how this budget is targeted, there are some extraordinary gaps. There's been a real focus on trying to get young people into the job market. And I mean, I think that is actually important, and the focus on young people really matters. But I see some real inconsistencies here. So on the one hand, it's how do we get young people into paid employment? But we are not putting any more money into childcare. So for that cohort of people from their late teens into their mid-30s, you know, for women in that cohort, what matters most in terms of being able to enter paid employment? It's having affordable, high-quality childcare that you can pay for, but also feel comfortable about leaving your child in. Now, I think this is one of the things that we often miss from the childcare debate. It's affordability, but it's also knowing that it's high quality, that your child is looked after and loved. So there are a whole lot of issues that are missing around childcare here. And the other thing when we're talking about younger people is, yes, we need to think about employment, but what is the most critical crisis facing young people at the moment? And that's the future around climate change and the climate emergency. And again, that's missing. So we have this really very patchy approach to trying to support young people, where we're relying entirely on getting people into paid employment, but we're missing these really fundamentally important things about people's lives now and into the future.
Isn't that interesting, just to see the commonality between aged care and childcare, the way in which we value the caring profession, okay, the nurses and the assistants in nursing who care for our aged care resident population, and the way in which we've funded aged care, which is potentially improving the amount of money that's being made out of that, extraordinary discussions around the financing of it, which really undervalues the work that's being done in caring. And it's the same in childcare, that we extraordinary investment to care for each other. It's been one of the messages of the coronavirus pandemic is that as a community, we're ready to do extraordinary things to look after each other. And that was the opportunity that was presented to this government with this budget. And it's profoundly disappointing to see it missed.
Yeah, I mean, we seem to have put a dollar value around care and have tried to profitise care rather than thinking deeply about an ethic of care.
Yep.
And you're right, Anna Greta, we've seen this happening in communities, in the streets around us. So it is a tragic missed opportunity not to really rethink what our society means and then how we support that through the budget and through other mechanisms.
And when you think in aged care of the obscene profits that are being made while the people in those facilities are, subject to absolutely unconscionable neglect, and the workforce is absolutely exploited and insecure, this is something that none of us should countenance.
John, we talked there about some of the sort of blind spots in the budget, some of the things, the seemingly obvious things that have been missed. And in a normal year from this government, you would expect that they would say money is limited, they're going to spend it on what they think is a priority. But this was a huge spending budget, and it was a huge opportunity to rethink the type of society that we actually want going into the future and what it might look like coming out of the coronavirus crisis. Why do you think the government didn't take that?
Oh, look, I think it's, I think we've got to stop talking about things being missed or left out. I think this is a very deliberate framing, a very deliberate attempt in the first instance to prepare for the next election, hence the trinkets and baubles that have been distributed. Secondly, to reward mates and punish enemies. And thirdly, to embed some of those neoliberal values of reducing labour costs, disciplining the working class, including those who've been residualised, dismantling the public sphere, social infrastructure. I mean, neoliberals hate the public sphere because it reeks to them of democracy, the democratisation of life. They hate it, especially with us in it. And so to me, it's absolutely no oversight. It's not a mistake that, no serious investment in First Nations communities. No, a refusal to address the recession's disproportionate impact on women, a rejection of the really promising possibility of a care-led recovery, a refusal to make the much needed massive investment in education. From early childhood education, which really should be universal and free. It would have a huge economic and social impact if that were the case. Public school education is being grossly underfunded, at the expense of largesse to private schools that have absolutely no need of those public resources. And then, of course, to talk about, jobs for young people and not talk about TAFE, is just absolute, it just beggars belief. This should be treated as a national treasure, not to be denuded the way it has been. And then, I don't need to talk to you about the betrayal of the higher education sector. Universities have just been punished big time. So, education, another area. And then, of course, social housing. Absolute unanimity across the experts from academia, from the community sector, from the union movement, from even the business community, saying a massive injection in social housing would be an incredible economic stimulus. It's also much, much needed. Uhuru estimates that we've got a shortfall of over 430,000 homes. This cries out for a bold national vision. This is the kind of visionary thing that we would have loved to have seen at this incredibly important juncture. And what do we get? Zero. We get belief in the trickle down theory. All the government could bring itself to do was to tell us to keep calm and wait for the wealth to trickle down.
All right. Well, I want to drill down a little more into the kind of messages that the government is sending with its priorities in the budget. But this seems like a good point to take a quick break. So we'll be back in just a second.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Okay, welcome back. Let's talk a little more about the message the government is sending with this budget. The budget is heavy on tax cuts, and businesses will benefit largely from asset write-offs. The changes also mean that any losses incurred up to June 2022 can be offset against prior profits made in the last 2 years. And on the other side, the government isn't planning any increases to the job seeker rate, which will return to pre-pandemic levels in December when the coronavirus supplement ceases. Sharon, what do you think the message the government is sending in its budget?
Well, I think John summed it up quite beautifully before the break. I think what we see are a particular set of values, a particular ideology at play, which is not surprising. It's around the importance of the market, of a market-led recovery, the importance of both deregulation, but where you have investment in the private sector and in business, and a faith that that will work. But I think there's a short-termism around it as well, because we don't see any serious thinking about the long-term, about the kind of investment. You know, John talked about social housing. You know, there's a long-term vision that could be fundamental to the recovery. Anna Greta talked about a care-led recovery. Again, there's a long-term vision. But I think what worries me most, and when you talk about the cuts to JobSeeker and, you know, the possibility at some point of returning to the kinds of levels that we saw at Newstart, it's the lack of humanity that really concerns me about that. And a lot of the research that I do is with children who are experiencing disadvantage. And, you know, before the pandemic, we talked with children about their experiences of living both in low-income families but in marginalised families, often where there was a reliance on benefits. We're talking 10-year-old children who are worried about increases in rents. We're talking about 10-year-old children who know the cost of petrol per litre or what a litre of milk costs. And they know that because they can't afford it, or they know the trade-offs that their families are making to afford those essentials. I cannot understand how we as a society and how our government as our leaders are prepared to countenance a society where so many children live like that. No, we've got nearly 18%, prior to the pandemic, nearly 18% of Australian children living below the poverty line. This is just not acceptable. So we have to challenge and rethink the kinds of values that we've allowed to frame our society, because there is such a deep humanity to what we're allowing to happen.
And investing in that makes economic sense.
It really
does.
It makes
big economic sense, not in the short term and in the longer term. You know, it resonates then through generations. We know children who grow up in a situation that you describe, and that's a large proportion or large minority of our current cohort of children, that the health impacts of that resonate for decades into their adult life. And that then is reflected in the health budgets that we need to spend. And so the potential for cost saving by changing towards a much more compassionate and caring environment, they're significant.
John, on Tuesday, following the budget announcement, you said that the budget, through its reliance on tax breaks and deregulation, was typical of a neoliberal trickle-down approach to economics. And you mentioned that earlier. Over the last 6 months, a lot of conservative governments around the world have had to be much more sort of Keynesian in their approach to economics. They've had to pump large amounts of money into their economies to kind of keep them afloat. Do you think that this budget was an attempt to sort of reset for the government in its kind of core conservative values?
Absolutely. So, you know, it was a glimmer of hope to see at the beginning of the pandemic the fact that the government listened to the union movement and instituted a wage subsidy, profoundly flawed though it was, leaving out big chunks of the workforce that was quite a deliberate exclusion in my view, but still we had a wage subsidy there, and we know the fact that it has cushioned the blow to the economy, and most importantly to workers' lives. And secondly, that massive and much needed boost through the coronavirus supplement to the job seeker payment. We know the data is there that it literally lifted people out of poverty. And we also know that the recent cut has plunged many back into poverty. And, you know, as we have all agreed, what does the future hold? You know, that sense of uncertainty, of economic and social insecurity for people who are unemployed, people who are, you know, all of those who have been residualized by the labor market, you know, appear to, I suppose, be punished for their own exclusion. Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, you're seeing this an intervention into people's lives to discipline and very paternalistically control and infantilize in many cases people because they are deemed of no value, you know, a bit like what you were saying before, Sharon, about you know, no monetary value attached to caring. So if it hasn't got an economic valorization, it's devoid of any kind of social valorization. Now, this is the market taking over society. You know, I like to think of, you know, think of a village and there's a marketplace. It might be in the centre of the village and that's lovely. You know, everyone sees it as a really positive thing. But when the marketplace takes over the entire village and there's nothing left but market, when the market invades every corner of our lives, this is dehumanising because profit comes before people. And so it's no surprise that this budget is seeing a real snap back to that vicious ideology that dehumanizes people. Dehumanizes people because they are outside the market somehow, you know, in the view of the government. And of course, we've got to think more broadly of the working class. In, you know, completely from those on good incomes to those on highly precarious low incomes, as a whole, the working class continues to be punished with the greater threat of insecurity, and that, you know, there's no indication of a move away from wage stagnation, let alone any promise of an increase to social security payments. It's all focused on greater profitability, and somehow by magic, even though it's never happened, the wealth's going to trickle down, and we should just be patient. But you know, as I said, yeah, all we hear is the sound of the excluded still waiting, and yet we're meant to be grateful for whatever crumbs fall from the table. And it's not just by way of excluding some of those big ticket items that I listed earlier. There were some incredible instances of cruelty. You know, cutting 41.3 million from homelessness services. Even I was astonished by that. You know, to reduce the refugee intake, instigate this 500 hours of English language classes for people on partner visas. You know, all acts of cruelty against those perceived to be not the enemies of the people, but the enemies of the government, which in turn is framing itself as an enemy of the people.
I think one of the perhaps concerning things about the budget is that it is a very big spending budget. And I think most people would agree that in this context, that was necessary. But it does mean that we now will have by 2024, the $1 trillion debt. So that requires repayment, but it also locks us into a particular trajectory. So we've now accepted almost a particular pathway because of the amount of spending, rather than being able to take on some of these issues and have a genuine national conversation around what kind of society we want, rather than locking ourselves onto a particular pathway that really leaves no space for thinking differently about the importance of care, about social housing, about how we support people who are excluded, and how we create inclusion. So I think that's perhaps one of the most worrying parts about it, that it's locking us onto a pathway.
I mean, it strikes me that there is, on what you're saying, there is a dissonance here insofar as we talked about, Sharon, you talked about the amount of children that are living in poverty, staggering figure, almost one in five. The unemployment rate is predicted to peak at 8%, but of course we know that the underemployment rate is very much higher than that. Yet the government has opted for tax cuts as a means to sort of rebuild the economy. But it strikes me that a lot of those people who are excluded, who are suffering, make up a large percentage of Australia. So how is this budget likely to play politically, given that so many of the Australians who will be voting are those same Australians who are actually suffering?
Look, I think that's really hard to predict. The idea of tax cuts has become such a, I think, John, you referred to it as a bauble or a shiny thing. I think the idea of a tax cut has become so embedded in our psyche as something that benefits us all, that there's a kind of a particular aura around tax cuts that plays very well with the electorate. But I think you're right, Martin. There are large numbers of people that are really being left behind. The timing will be all important in terms of when the election is and how we're starting to feel some of these issues bite. I do think that where we may well see a backlash against the approach that the government's taking is from women. You know, we know that women have been really deleteriously impacted in terms of employment, in terms of the amount of care work that they've taken on with school lockdowns and so on. We know that domestic violence has spiked during the pandemic. So we see women being really negatively impacted, but we see no concern whatsoever within the budget or the government's policy more broadly about gender equality. And this is quite extraordinary from a country that really pioneered some of the leading approaches globally to gender equality. You know, we had in the 1970s an Office for Women. We had women's budgets in place for many years that were designed to prevent budgets being put in place that discriminated against women. So I think there are significant parts of the electorate, like half that are women, that are likely to see this budget as leaving them out entirely. Certainly if you're unemployed or in precarious work, as John says, you're not going to see this budget as supporting you. But I think in terms of the electoral cycle, timing is going to be all important. And some of these cuts have been very carefully timed, with some of the tax cuts being claimed at the end of the tax year, which may well align with an election.
I mean, I think you see that there is a discomfort amongst those who are receiving tax cuts. There's a fair number of people who are commenting that they don't need those tax cuts. In fact, that narrative was present at the last budget last year. People saying, actually, this money could go somewhere else and be used much more wisely. But as we see inequity grow, and I shared John's concern on this quite deeply, how do we see that play out in terms of the politics? I might be making assumptions here, but I think you see that play into the sorts of moderately crazy-looking politics we see in places like the United States and partly in the UK, where we're making angry decisions with government rather than making constructive decisions that are future-minded. And that's what probably worries me the most is I'd like to see the revolution come. I'd like to see us all work together to make a country which cares for each other, that respects each other, that offers at least an adequate level of dignity to every single Australian, and including housing. But I think more likely we're going to see anger grow. And anger can be so politically difficult in the world that we're in at the moment that it could be a really difficult time ahead.
Anna Gret, I want to stay with you. The budget didn't give any clear indication of whether Australia will achieve net zero carbon emissions. But it does include the funding promise to renewable energy support agencies, which is supposed to focus on the development of low carbon technology. Should climate change mitigation have been a bigger part of Australia's economic recovery plans?
I guess the summer we've just had feels like it was light years ago, doesn't it, really? But if there was a large proportion of the Australian population, and we know, in fact, it's a really small number of people who don't share concerns around climate change. But if there was a larger proportion, that was certainly altered in a radical way by the summer that we went through with the bushfires. Half the Australian population, it's estimated around 12 million people, were exposed to hazardous levels of air pollution from the bushfire season. And so it is one of the biggest threats that we face. We're up against an extraordinary period of economic uncertainty and social change. But over the next decade or so, climate change and the changing climate, as the government prefers to describe it, is really going to have a profound impact on the health and well-being on our society more broadly. And so this was the budget where we had an opportunity to really invest in that. There are so many effective, non-controversial, cost-effective, you know, growth-focused energy transition models that are out there, and the government really failed to take that on board and to take that opportunity. I think particularly concerning, though, is that a lot of the economic investment from a business perspective will be going towards mining. And we know that a lot of that mining will then increase global carbon dioxide emissions. And so our federal budget has just increased global carbon dioxide emissions and is contributing then in a very significant way ongoing to climate change.
Okay. Let me stay with you for one other topic, Anna Greta. The COVID-19 pandemic has obviously left people's mental health in dire need and care providers struggling to meet that particular demand. And as part of the budget, the number of Medicare-funded psychological services will be doubled, and telehealth services subsidies will be extended to March next year. Are things like that going to help alleviate the burden on people and care providers?
I think those are really important contributions from the government. I think telehealth has helped people access medical services where they otherwise wouldn't have been able to. I think that's been really important. When I look after people, and I'm still working as a doctor, I'm seeing amongst the community subtle and slow deteriorations in our health this year. Most of us have been spending more time at home. There's been a change in our exercise pattern. I have to confess, in my office, my subjective experience is that it's around 80% of us have gained weight. Most of us have put on a couple of kilos. They're called corona kilos. So if we reflect and just take the pulse of the health of our community at the end of 2020 compared to the end of 2019, as a population, we're not as well as we were. We're not as healthy as we were. And so the investment strategy there requires some creativity, I think. It's a really extraordinary opportunity for our Department of Health and for our health service to invest in preventative care and to really think about how to support a community that is up against a range of challenges that haven't been faced before. And so I think that's another missed opportunity, but it's another way that we could potentially reframe the discussion is towards thinking about how we look after each other, how we can foster community care and responsibility through a pandemic which is ongoing. We haven't fixed this problem yet.
I don't have the experience of seeing patients that Anna Greta does, but I do see our students here at the ANU. And I think we're seeing that slow deterioration in students' sense of well-being and resilience as well. I think when this pandemic started and we went into lockdown, it's kind of like, we'll get through this. We'll all get through this together. But it's now been a very long time. I think we're really starting to see some people struggle greatly. And alongside that, with what I'm seeing amongst young people who are studying, are the messages from the government around what they think of the university sector, that there is no investment in this sector, there's no value and worth placed on this sector, and that some types of knowledge and learning are completely disregarded as having any value. So, you know, that again adds to that mental anguish that young people are feeling about what they want to make of their lives. We see alongside of that the only emphasis in support, or the primary emphasis in supporting young people about getting them into work, even if it is precarious, low-paid work at 20 hours a week. Yeah. And so I think, you know, if you put all of these things together, we see a budget that claimed to be concerned about young people because of the focus on employment support, but we see these broader counter messages that are really undermining young people's well-being, but also undermining the things that they will often really value, both at the moment, but in terms of the kinds of futures they want to carve out for themselves. So it's not surprising that we're seeing that erosion in well-being when these are the kinds of messages that we're seeing coming out around what's valued and what's not.
Yeah, no, there was a study actually published from the ANU team looking at the mental health impacts of the coronavirus. And it's the first of a longer-term cohort study. And if I'm interpreting the information correctly, it looks like loneliness is a really dominant driver for adverse mental health. And so Do we have structures in this budget that help us to address loneliness, to improve social interconnectedness? And do we know that that improves health and wellbeing? Yes, we do. We know that. And so this is the missed opportunity. This is the absence of vision. This is particularly concerning that it looks like it's a 12-month plan and that it's not imagining what we might be going through over the next 5 or 10 or even 25 years. And so we had an extraordinary opportunity to improve that health, and we've missed it.
And it's a very expensive 12-month
plan. Very expensive 12 months, absolutely.
So this has been a fascinating discussion, and thank you to all three of you. We are going to have to draw it to a close. But before we do, I want to pick up on this whole thing about imagination and give you a bit of an exercise in imagination. Now, we know that expenses for 2020 to 2021 are likely to be in the region of $670 billion. So I'd like to ask all of you, if you were Treasurer and, by the power vested in me as host of Policy Forum Pod, I am going to appoint you as Treasurer for a second. How would you have spent the money? You've got $670 billion to play with. Where would be your spending priorities? Perhaps, Anna Greta, if I start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually a fabulously good question. I think it's the question we should all be asking. I think we should be starting, in fact, by having as many community conversations about that exact question as we can have. I think it's really time to engage as many people as possible in what we do with our money and why we do it. And so that would be what informs how I'd use that money. I would certainly start by working with communities. And I think, community work actually underpins a lot of the climate change response. We know that adaptation strategies or work around working with communities is really important in responding to extreme weather. So investments like community-based renewable energy projects, provides investments and resources that are shared within communities. And Helen Haynes has got some great policy work out at the moment on this. So I'd start with renewable energy investment because I think that's a good source of long-term employment. It's a nice way to engage communities into the way in which their cities and their spaces run. I would make sure that everybody has access to adequate levels of housing and resources that provide dignity. I'm using Sharon Friel's statement, but dignity is so tremendously important. I probably question how much we need to work, and I wonder if now is a good time to think about that relationship between work and caring and the social relationship that we all play, and giving people an opportunity to work part-time in a way that means that the activities that generate revenue can be shared. But we also at the same time value the caring relationship, so parenting, caring for older people, caring for younger people within the community. And so that's some of how I'd spend the money. I've got a very long list. I'd be very happy to give advice.
Well, that's a good budget speech. Sharon, what about you? You've got $670 billion burning a hole in your pocket. What are you going to do with that?
So I think the first thing that I would want to do if I was Treasurer would probably be rely on advice of experts and others, but I would want to have a conversation. But to me, there are three things, and I think this really is echoing what Anna Greta just said, but there are three C's that are fundamentally important that we need to be thinking about funding and supporting, and that's climate, care, and community. And so around climate, it's the kind of things that Anna Greta said. It's about how we invest in renewable energy and how we make that work for us through research, through development, through innovation. How do we become a world leader in this area? And we have the capacity to do that so that we are actually creating jobs that are the jobs of the future, and we're caring for the climate at the same time, or we're dealing with the climate emergency at the same time. In terms of care, I think it's a great point that you make, Anna Greta, which is how much do we need to work and what are some of the trade-offs? What might a well-being economy look like if it's driven not by growth but by an ethic of care? So thinking particularly about how we support those people who Richard Titmuss described in the 1950s as being at points of natural dependency in life, children, older people, people who are living with a disability, how do we support and care for those people so that they are not left behind, they don't become some of the excluded that John's talking about? I think it's time in that context to have a serious conversation about something like a basic living income. Elise Klein here at Crawford, John Quiggin and others have done work around that and have costed it. I think that's a conversation that we need to have. And how does that kind of approach to our social security and to our economic management contribute to a principle of care? And finally, how do we support communities and how do we invest in communities in a way that addresses this crisis of loneliness that people are facing? How do we connect communities so that they are able to support one another? So those three C's of climate, care and community would be what would shape my thinking about funding.
John, earlier you identified some of the public policy areas in dire need of investment, which actually didn't receive any, particularly, notably Indigenous communities, the dire need that we have for public housing. So you've got $670 billion to play with. Where would you spend that money?
Oh, look, I'm in furious agreement with my colleagues, I have to say. It's just a matter of how you frame it. I guess, to me, we've got to acknowledge that nothing gets fixed or healed in Australia without beginning with addressing the historical fact of colonisation. It's the fundamental contradiction that we must face as a nation if we're going to fix anything else. And so that would be the very first thing. And it wouldn't be a top-down, the opposite to the dreadful Northern Territory intervention, something that begins from the First Nations peoples saying what it is that needs to change rather than non-Indigenous Australia telling First Nations communities what is best for them, in the shocking and disempowering and violent tradition of colonisation. So that will translate into a massive investment in First Nations communities, including housing, including all of the social determinants of health, including all of the things that are desperately needed in order to address our unconscionable level of incarceration of First Nations peoples and deaths in custody. So that's number one. Number two, I guess I'd frame very broadly as social and economic infrastructure, including a massive expansion of the public sector, against the grain of increased marketisation and privatisation and outsourcing. We're going to see the greatest level of accountability, of democracy, of service to the people rather than priority given to profit through an expanded, an intelligently expanded public sector. And so that covers, not just big physical economic infrastructure, which is very important, including social housing, which I mentioned earlier, but all the things we call social infrastructure, including all of the foundational economy, the economy of caring, including education, including health, all of those areas, and social services, of course. And I'm reminded, in 1948, Nye Bevan, at the time of the creation of the National Health Service in Britain, he famously said, I just love this. He said, "Social services give people a share of the national product in accordance with their need." An absolutely revolutionary notion because it cuts the nexus between access to a service and income. It's saying, you should have access to what you need, not to what you can afford, which I think needs to be part of the way we think about that social and economic infrastructure, which leads me to the third area, and it goes to what you were saying, Anna Greta, about rethinking work. I think the whole area of how we work and how we live, that so including interconnectedness, including the manufacturing of precarity. Judith Butler, the great theorist, she talks about life is naturally precarious because we are vulnerable as humans. We depend on the other. But precarity is a political intervention to ramp up that precariousness to a level where it becomes, where people become subject to violence and injury, and the inability to live life. And that's what we're seeing through the trickle down theory in practice. That's what we're seeing through that invasion of the market into every aspect of our lives. So we need to address, you know, how we work to eliminate exploitation and insecurity in the workplace, and to ensure that you know, the simple way I like to put it is that all of us have a fair crack at happiness.
Well, I have really enjoyed this discussion today. Lots of positive ideas around the table. So I want to thank all of you, Anna Greta, John and Sharon, for sharing your thoughts with us today. It's much appreciated. Listeners, what are your thoughts, ideas and concerns about the budget? Let us know. Our Facebook group is the direct line to our presenters, to other listeners and even some of our panellists. You can find us as Policy Forum Pod on Facebook. Or you can get in touch on Twitter where we're Apps Policy Forum, that's APPS Policy Forum. And of course, you can reach us the old-fashioned way via email at podcast@policyforum.net. Now, before we let you go, just a quick reminder that we've got the final episode of our special Making the Invisible Visible mini-series coming up next week. For those of you who have been listening, you'll know that throughout this six-part bonus series, we've been shining a light on poverty with researchers from Crawford School's Individual Measure of Multidimensional Deprivation Project. And on the final episode, host Artie Betageri welcomes back none other than Sharon Bessel to talk about how the advent of the COVID-19 pandemic has affected poverty rates and how poverty is experienced. If you're keen to listen in, new episodes come out every Tuesday through the Policy Forum Pod feed. So hit subscribe now to make sure you don't miss out, and you can catch up on all the previous episodes on whatever podcast platform you listen to. Policy Forum Pod is, of course, available on Acast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you can normally get your podcasts from. We'll be back with another episode of Policy Forum Pod next week, but until then, cheerio for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.